America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. I saw an article in Newsweek Online. Yeah, that's right. I was a longtime subscriber. It's still there, somewhere in the cloud. And the article was entitled, Why Are We Still Living in Ronald Reagan's America? The author is a very interesting man, a historian, whom I had interviewed years back when he wrote a biography of Ronald Reagan. Turns out he thought the headline was somewhat off his point. But hey, it got my attention. On this podcast, we discuss what GOP lineage exists from the Reagan era to the Trump era, and where the latter presidency parted company with the former. You may never have heard a discussion on this topic, and never as nuanced. I assure you, you're going to learn something today on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is H.W. Brand, a history professor at the University of Texas at Austin, author of Reagan, The Life. And it's fascinating because he wrote a piece that was titled by Newsweek, Why We Are Still Living in Ronald Reagan's America. And that took me aback because I remember the morning in America, the sunny disposition of Ronald Reagan. And then I went back to 2017 and the inaugural address of Donald Trump. And that was carnage in America. So it doesn't feel like we're still living back in the 1980s to me.
Yeah, well, Larry, I was a little bit surprised myself when I read the headline that Newsweek had put on my essay, because they asked me to write a piece on Ronald Reagan and sort of what remains of the Reagan legacy. And the essay itself gives kind of a mixed report, but the headline writers for the magazine, you know, they put the headline on it. So what I will say is this, and what I say in the essay, is that trends that were visible during Reagan's presidency have continued. And so one can see in the America of today, and in fact, much of the essay focuses specifically on the Republican Party. So is the Republican Party of today Ronald Reagan's Republican Party? And the short answer is, well, it's the same party, of course it has the same name, and it is true that certain developments that were underway when Reagan was president, some of which he gave assistance to, continued to produce the Republican Party we have today. But I conclude the essay pretty much in the way you did, juxtaposing. I said that there's a striking difference between the Republican Party of Donald Trump, where he talks about carnage in America and how, you know, everything is wrong with America and only I can save this, with the persistent optimism of Ronald Reagan. And I conclude with the line you quote, that Reagan believed that America's brightest day was always ahead of it. So there's a family resemblance between America today and the America of the 1980s, between the Republican Party of today and the Republican Party of the 1980s. But it doesn't get much closer than that.
Well, ironically, the person who has picked up that mantle of a sunny future for America, and there's nothing that America can't do when it puts its mind to it, and trying to bring us together in that sense, is Joe Biden.
Right. And in fact, Joe Biden is in many ways a product of that era. He's, of course, younger than Reagan would have been, but he was a figure in politics. And one of the things that unites Joe Biden, current president, and Ronald Reagan, president during the 1980s, was a pragmatic understanding of what politics is for, what getting elected is for. Getting elected is to produce some progress toward the goal that you've promised voters when you were campaigning. And it's not primarily to score points. It's not primarily to do the other side in. So for Joe Biden, as for Ronald Reagan, pragmatism was not, is not a dirty word. Compromise is not a dirty word. Compromise is the way political progress comes. In the essay, I quote Reagan as, you know, saying that I'd rather get 80% of what I want than go over the cliff with my flag flying. And that is the hallmark of, I'll say, politicians of an earlier generation, because we live at a time really since about the mid-1990s, when Newt Gingrich and his Republican Party sort of announced their contract for America, or a contract on America, and basically decided to wage perpetual politics as perpetual war. And the Democrats sort of responded to that, picked up on some of that. And so it's much more common nowadays for the parties to position themselves in a way that allows them the greatest freedom to continue to complain about the problem, but to work toward a solution. Biden, like Reagan, these are old school politicians who, you know, we got elected to get something done. And so there is that, it is somewhat ironic that that is the closer resemblance between Ronald Reagan and a Democratic president than between Ronald Reagan and any obvious member of the Republican Party today.
Well, you remind us in this fine article, despite the headline, that Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan met regularly. I would imagine that Nancy Pelosi and Donald Trump never met alone regularly, that they compromised on taxes, welfare, Social Security, immigration, and boy, does that stand out as a major departure of that Republican Party from where we are today, and we will talk about that. But that was so important that let's work things out. And one of the things that certainly is really apparent now and wasn't during the Trump administration is that they're wearing out the rugs going in and out of the White House, trying to bring people of all different stripes in, whether they ultimately agree on an infrastructure package or whatever it may be, that he wants to hear from everyone, and he's trying to accommodate both his own progressive wing and the more conservative group in the Republican Party today.
Well, I think that certainly is a connection between the Biden administration and the Reagan administration. Now, some of the change in American politics was bigger than Reagan, bigger than Biden. It was a result of things that were happening in the nation as a whole, between the parties as a whole. And one of the things I point out in the essay and in my book on Reagan is that Reagan had an advantage, an enormous advantage of good timing in becoming president when he became president, because the transformation in the political parties that had begun in the mid to late 1960s was still underway. It hadn't reached its completion. And the hallmark of this transformation was that conservative Southern Democrats were abandoning the Democratic Party and moving to the Republican Party. They were more conservative than most people in the Democratic Party. They were more conservative than a substantial number of Republicans, but they were legacy Democrats because of memories that went back to the Civil War and Reconstruction. They simply wouldn't be Republicans because they saw the Republican Party as the party that waged war on their grandpappies. But they sort of took it as permission to leave the Democratic Party when Lyndon Johnson nailed the mast of the National Democratic Party to nail the flag of the Democratic Party to the mast of civil rights. And many of those conservative Southerners, almost all white Southerners, decided, you know, this is no longer the party that I'm most comfortable in. And so they gradually began a great march, a long march to the Republican Party. And it took almost two generations. So if you were 65 years old and a Democrat in Mississippi or Texas in 1965 when the Voting Rights Act was passed, you probably didn't abandon the Democratic Party. You didn't re-register as a Republican. You simply stopped voting for Democratic candidates. If you were younger, if you were, say, young Rick Perry, who at the time was going to go on to become governor of Texas, but if you were sort of the beginning politician, you probably did switch parties midstream. Phil Gramm was elected to the U.S. Senate in 1980 as a Republican. But then as a Democrat, then he decided to switch parties. He resigned, to his credit, and in a special election was reelected as a Republican. So there were those who switched, and then younger, sort of the children of these people, never were Democrats. They were all Republican. But the result was that the two parties were sifting themselves out philosophically. In 1960, there were liberal Republicans as well as conservative Republicans. There were conservative Democrats as well as liberal Democrats. By the 1990s, there weren't any liberal Republicans left. They had all become Democrats. And there weren't any conservative Democrats left. They had all become Republicans. And so by 2000, it was really hard to find enough philosophical overlap between the two parties to get much in the way of bipartisan legislation done. And bipartisanship is crucial to making any important changes legislatively, changes that will persist. You have to get at least some members of the other party on board. Otherwise, you simply invite the out party to campaign against whatever measure you pass. And we see this in the response to the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. So the Republicans wouldn't give any assistance to a Democratic president, and they spent the next 10 years campaigning against Obamacare. Now, Reagan became president at a time when the shift was underway, but there were still enough conservative Democrats that on all those reforms that you just mentioned, when he was talking to Tip O'Neill, Reagan could appeal to conservative Democrats. He could use that as leverage against Tip O'Neill, who was a pretty liberal Democrat. And the result was that all those reforms in welfare, immigration, Social Security, everything else, they had a bipartisan seal of approval, which made them lasting. And on all those, we haven't had any comparable reforms ever since, because within another 10 years, what Reagan had accomplished with his pragmatism, with his willing to compromise, would have been very much more difficult because there wouldn't have been anybody to compromise with. And every president after Reagan, well, Clinton gets a little bit of the holdover effect, but by the time you get to George W. Bush, there's not a whiff of bipartisanship around. Now, perhaps Joe Biden is going to be able to resurrect some of this. It will be vastly to his credit if he's able to do it. You know, we'll have to wait and see how everything turns out.
When we do look at it, I mean, that's such an important point, and I've reported on that before. It's just people don't take that into account, how we used to have these big tent parties, and a lot of the compromises would actually come intra-party, and then they'd come to the table at a more centrist point, both of them, and they'd be able to make deals as opposed to coming at each other from vastly different extremes. Having said that, I'm thinking now as you're talking, did Ronald Reagan – in effect, have more impact on the Democratic Party than the Republican Party? There are people who say today that he couldn't even get the Republican nomination. And yet, when you think about Bill Clinton saying that the era of big government is over, and you see where a more centrist Democrat in Joe Biden was the nominee against many more progressive Democrats, I'm just wondering if Ronald Reagan and his tenure, and much of it very successful in practice getting what he wanted through, at least 80%, as you say, might have had more impact on the Democratic Party than the Republican.
In some ways it did, because it really it drove almost the last nails in the coffin of the Great Society and the idea that was common among Democrats, certainly, during the 60s and 70s, and a lot of Republicans bought into it as well, is if there's a big problem out there, government is the way to solve the problem. And Reagan famously announced in his first inaugural address that, no, government's not the solution, government's the problem. And that was so effective in gathering votes that for the new Democrats of the 1990s, led by Bill Clinton, they basically took that same position. Government isn't the solution. You know, the era of big government is over. And in that respect, what Reagan embodied and articulated is still with us. Considering the amount of money that's been thrown at infrastructure and COVID relief and all this, which suggests, well, maybe it's back. Another thing that I developed in the book, I didn't have a chance to do much in the essay, was Reagan really transformed the Republican Party in a way that Republicans have never acknowledged and about which, so from a philosophical standpoint, least from the standpoint of philosophical consistency, they should not be proud. And what Reagan did was to detach the Republican Party from the concept of fiscal conservatism. Republicans before Reagan were the party of the balanced budget. They wanted smaller government. This is going to be smaller in taxes and smaller in spending. What Reagan succeeded in doing, especially during his first term, was cutting taxes, but he never succeeded in cutting spending. And so by the end of Reagan's term as president, the Republicans, they still talked tax cuts, and they were all in favor of tax cuts. So the Republicans, you know, all took the pledge that we will never vote to raise taxes. We always cut taxes, you know, cut taxes in good times, cut taxes in bad times. But they stopped talking much about balancing the budget. And they essentially took up the position that had been associated with Democrats previously, the deficits don't matter. And you know, the last two administrations have demonstrated, yeah, the Republicans as well as Democrats are willing to break the bank when it comes to spending. And with Reagan, you know, Reagan could have held the Democrats' feet to the fire, because when he was negotiating with Tip O'Neill on budgets and taxes, he wanted, we'll cut taxes and we'll cut spending too. Okay? And Reagan said, okay, we'll agree with your tax cuts, but we'll come along with the spending cuts later. And Reagan might very well have said, hey, no deal. You know, we're going to get them both together. But Reagan understood that tax cuts were easy. Even Democrats have to cut taxes, because when they run for reelection, they can tell constituents, hey, I lowered you taxes. Everybody likes free money that way. Cutting spending is a lot harder. And he was willing to sort of accept this promissory note for the spending cuts, which he never got because he had lost his leverage. So in that respect, again, that's something that Reagan never boasted about, but in real terms, Reagan doubled the federal debt. So he rolled up more federal debt in his 8 years in office as the previous every president back to George Washington for roll up. And that was a huge difference. But again, that's not something he boasted about. He talked about the tax cuts. And the thinking was, well, we're going to cut taxes and then the government revenues will be squeezed and we'll starve the beast. Well, no, the beast didn't starve. He just had a credit card and ran up the debt after that.
The road to Trump from Reagan, looking for that line. For example, you talk about deregulation that facilitated some pretty dramatic changes in the economy, including the democratization of air travel, and in part that was Jimmy Carter, globalizing production and supply chains, and the digital revolution. Now, a lot of people don't really see that part. But you've got to explain that, because the globalization of production and supply chains, very much a part of what it was that Ronald Reagan might have left, at least as part of the lineage, to Donald Trump to assail.
Right. And so globalization was generally thought to be a good thing during the 1980s. You know, 1970s, 1980s, this is what had prevented World War III, because countries that had previously been bitter enemies now were each other's best trading partners. And what came to be seen as the downside of globalization was less apparent to many people in the 1980s. By the 1990s, things had changed. But in the 1980s, it was perfectly fine for the Republicans, for Ronald Reagan to be all in favor of free trade, and for plenty of Democrats to take that position too. Now, it was connected to the deregulation scheme of American railroads, American airlines, American shipping, because now all of a sudden, you know, we'll let the market drive the price down to whatever the price of transportation is going to be. And people get used to the idea. If you just look at the number of things that people bought that were made overseas in the 1960s compared to what were made overseas by the year 2000, you know, the stuff that was made in the United States has largely disappeared. And that shows up in a standard of living that Americans often don't connect to politics. They just get used to the idea that I can go to Walmart and can buy a decent quality T-shirt for $10. You know, if that had been made in the United States, it would have cost $30 or something like that. And so in that regard, Americans kind of get hooked on this globalization, but there are groups that are suffering job losses and other things through this. And gradually those become talking points. And then eventually
sort of battle point for the Trump administration, because Donald Trump came in basically looking to, well, in many ways, sort of wreck whatever he found. And one of the points that I make in the essay is that you can't blame this on Ronald Reagan exactly, but you can see how it grew out of Reagan's position. So Reagan said in his first inaugural address, in our present situation, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. So to say that government is the problem in this present circumstance is a fairly limited statement. But once you've declared government to be the problem, you sort of tempt those who come after you to up the ante. And so from government being the problem to government being the enemy is not an inevitable step, but it's a fairly likely step. And that's where we are by the time Donald Trump gets inaugurated. So, you know, government is the enemy. He's going to drain the swamp, and all he sees is carnage as he looks around the country. And so, you know, Reagan would never have said that government is the enemy, but he made jokes about it. You know, the scariest sentence in the American language is, I'm from the government, I'm here to help.
Right.
And so, and one of the things about Reagan is he had this sense of humor that allowed the philosophy to sort of go down easily. But you get somebody like Donald Trump who, if he had a sense of humor, it wasn't of that genial type. It wasn't of that self-deprecating type. It was always sort of humor at the expense of other people.
Yeah, I once thought, you know, he wanted to be Don Rickles more than he wanted to be president. Let me ask you about globalization. I thought you made a profound statement in the piece in Newsweek. Globalization aggravated deindustrialization of the U.S. and made supply chains sensitive to unforeseen disruptions like COVID-19. Help, you know, unpack that for us. But, you know, it's interesting. I live in a community where deindustrialization was really aggravated by bad politicians who were feeding off the carcass of an almost dead city that was so vital to America, Waterbury, Connecticut, way back when, where nobody would go to World War II without something that was made in Waterbury, the brass capital of the world. But I hadn't really thought about how globalization, I think many of us just tie those two things together and say all that deindustrialization was as a result of globalization, but you say globalization aggravated deindustrialization. Help us to understand that.
Yeah, so the golden age of American industry is often seen as the 1950s. And this is when the United States, coming out of World War II, when the American economy was the wonder of the world, and American factories churned out bombers and tanks and ships and everything else by the thousands and the thousands. And that sort of segued into the producer economy of the 1950s. But there was an overlooked aspect of that, at least overlooked often in the United States. And America's industrial advantage over its potential competitors in the 1950s was largely a consequence that the other obvious rivals of the United States had been flattened by World War II.
Yeah.
And so Germany and Japan, these were two industrial powers utterly destroyed by World War II. It was likely to the point of inevitable that they were going to revive, especially after the United States decided, and the U.S. government decided that it needed the assistance of Germany, West Germany, and Japan in containing communism. So the advantage that American industry, to focus on that, had in the 1950s was this sort of artificial advantage. And simply watching Japan and Germany revive meant that the United States by the 1960s would be in a competition it hadn't been in before. And so, you know, for the first time, you can buy Japanese cars. You can buy German cars in the United States. And GM and Ford and Chrysler have to compete in that regard. And in other areas. So some of that was inevitable. Some of that was natural, but didn't even require the deregulation. But the spirit of deregulation that comes along, and you correctly point out, Jimmy Carter started it, and Ronald Reagan then continued it, is based on the principle that we are going to let markets make decisions about what gets produced where and how it gets there. And we're not going to require government to approve changes to initially, say, truck routes and truck pay scales and, you know, the price list. And likewise for ships and trains and all this other stuff. We're just going to let what a capitalist economy do what capitalist economy does. And we're all going to reap the benefits from this. So there already was this new competition from overseas, and then the deregulation accelerates that, because now foreign companies are free to sell stuff in the U.S., and shipping companies can lower their prices so it's cheaper to get Volkswagens from Germany to the United States and so on. And some of this stuff was going to happen anyway. And there is automation of various manufacturing processes. That was going to happen anyway, sooner or later. And so it's the reason that I sort of chose the verb aggravate. So the deregulation globalization didn't create the deindustrialization of America, but it accelerated, aggravated what was already going on. And it was a whole lot easier by the 1990s to blame globalization than it was, say, blame computers, blame automation, because globalization gives you a foreign villain. And if you are a politician and you want to score points with constituents, you point a finger at somebody who can't vote against you. Point the finger at Japan, or later at China, or Germany, or wherever it might be, because they don't vote for American candidates in Germany, Japan, and China. Whereas if you said, okay, well, no, the problem is automation. Well, basically, you're blaming Americans for America's problems. And it's really tempting politically to blame those foreigners rather than to blame ourselves. There was a combination of all of this.
Yeah, 20% vote for Ross Perot back in that era. Now, income inequality, which, again, another one of these things that really has exacerbated, even though the cultural wars seem to supersede some of the economic ones, but they're all intertwined, that somebody's against you. And there's somebody pulling these strings in the deep state who really wants you to be, you know, let down by the system. And I'm going to drain the swamp, and I'm going to bring back your vitality in rural America or Midwestern states or whatever. And Donald Trump played on that. What role did Ronald Reagan play in this growing, yawning income inequality?
In the first place, deregulation allowed markets do what markets do, and they reward people who have good ideas and people who are a better place than other people. They allow companies to close down factories if the factories aren't making a profit that their owners consider necessary. So Reagan and Carter and Clinton and the elder Bush, the ones who, you know, went along with the idea of deregulation, they allowed things to happen that created this, what you described as this growing inequality of income. It wasn't political actions that positively created it. It was political decisions to back away from intervention in the market, and then the market did what it did. And a lot of this was also simply, in large part, due to the digital revolution. And so if you look at the big winners over the last 30 years, these are all tech people. And they're in industries that didn't exist in the 1980s. Well, and computers were started, Apple computer existed in the 1980s, but still, that were taking off. And these essentially transcended politics, or to put it another way, to keep Jeff Bezos from becoming the richest man in the world in the 2010s, government would have had to step in a way that it wasn't prepared to do and hadn't expected to do, because this was just the way the system was working. Now, if somebody wanted to say, okay, well, let Bezos make that money and then we'll tax him at a higher rate, okay, that's a separate matter. But in terms of just the way the economy developed, and a number of people have pointed out that the economy has become much more of a winner-take-all sort of economy. Mm. So if you are the first or the best Facebook, if you're the first social network, and of course it's not the first, but nonetheless it turned out to be the best, then you have an ability to squeeze out potential followers. And the same thing is true of various, you know, other aspects of this. Bezos, Amazon is such a behemoth now that it can elbow aside potential competitors. So there has been this transformation of the economy in a way that produces these very visible sort of high rollers, high income people. at a time when other people, well, actually, other people are getting richer too, just not as fast. And the closest analogy here is probably to the late 19th century, sort of the first Gilded Age. We might be in the second Gilded Age now. But in the first Gilded Age, you get the first really multi-centimillionaires in American history. You get John D. Rockefeller and Andrew Carnegie and people like that who have fortunes, you know, vaster than any before. And, but meanwhile, ordinary people, they're getting better off too. They're just not getting better off nearly at the same rate as the moguls.
Now, there were certain things from the Reagan era that led to some of the upset that Donald Trump took advantage of as he recreated the Republican Party in his image. But one thing that you point to, Ronald Reagan was not a racist, you say, but by invoking states' rights to justify conservative policies, he let Southerners, who were often racist, know that they could find a home in the GOP, a bit of a wink. And, of course, Donald Trump, in many ways, flirted with that same constituency.
So this question of what do you do about people who have views that offend other people? Well, you can. I suppose you could sort of take the really high road, and I don't want those people associating with me. But Reagan, in that regard, could take what I could call a pragmatic view. You could call it a cynical view, that those people have votes too. Reagan first had to deal with this issue when he was running for governor of California. And in those days, the conservative extremists were members of something called the John Birch Society. Mm-hmm. And these were folks who endorsed Reagan in his initial run for governor of California. And Reagan was asked to respond to this because there were people in California who thought that he ought to disavow the support of the John Birchers. And Reagan tried to finesse the issue by saying, hey, I didn't endorse them, they endorsed me. And he tried to draw a distinction there. Eventually, he was essentially compelled to, at least he decided it was a good idea to disavow some of the more extreme positions. But Republicans, starting with Reagan, not starting with Reagan, Republicans before that, George Wallace, he started out as a Democrat, but anyway. But people understood that those conservative Southerners, some of whom were racist, were going to find a home somewhere. So if they're not going to be in the Democratic Party, let them know they're going to find a home in the Republican Party. Now, critics could debate, does that mean that the Republican Party is racist? Well, it means that there are some people in the Republican Party that are racist, but we live in a democracy. Racists get to vote like everybody else. And if you're trying to win elections, if you can let them know that, okay, no, we'll listen to what you have to say, then they will find a home in the Republican Party. And you know, that's the way it worked out. Now, Donald Trump basically made it clear that this party under Donald Trump could be really friendly to some of these white nationalist types. And you know, Reagan sort of kept his distance from that. One could say maybe he was simply more subtle on this, but it's a fair question. What do? You say, no, we don't want your votes, and you go away? No, not necessarily. And of course, this is, I mean, people candidates justify this all the time. I'll take the votes whoever will vote for me, and then I'll govern according to my conscience. So,
well, yeah, when I look at the insurrection on January 6th, and I'm saying there are people doing somersaults to appeal to that group, and I look at that group and I say, why aren't you trying to educate them? Why aren't you trying to lift them up rather than acquiescing to who they are? And when you look at QAnon today and white supremacists and anti-vaxxers, they're all in this new do that we're all having to deal with, and I'll ask you about that in a moment. But I do want to say that there are two points, one of departure from Reagan to Trump and one in confluence with one another. The one in confluence is Reagan was a great communicator using television. Trump adapted to the ideas you point out of social media, but both of them very effective in their own way, using those modalities of the moment. And then, of course, the 11th Amendment, Ronald Reagan saying, do not besmirch other Republicans. And my goodness, right out of the gate, Donald Trump talking about John McCain, a war hero, former presidential candidate. Talk about a departure.
Right, right. And that's certainly true in characterizing Donald Trump. But it does explain the so-called 11th commandment, does explain to some degree the reluctance of other Republicans to criticize Donald Trump. Because there are a lot of people, not only Democrats, who said, my gosh, you know, how can Mitch McConnell, how can he stand for this kind of thing? And how can Kevin McCarthy, you know, how can they put up with this? Shouldn't they stand up and say, you know, what their principles are? And there is a strong temptation in politics, when your politics is dominated by two parties, to go out of your way not to weaken your own party unnecessarily. And if it means keeping your mouth shut, even when somebody in your party does something foolish or, you know, even, you know, downright counterproductive and dangerous, it takes a lot to get past that. Because if you are a leader of the Republican Party, you're thinking, okay, how can we win the White House back? And it's not going to help us win the White House back if we start a civil war within our own party. There are still a lot of Republicans who like Donald Trump. So don't offend them unnecessarily. Now, one can argue, wait a minute. Your conscience, your small d Democratic conscience ought to override that particular calculation. And maybe it should. But at least there is that temptation. Now, if we can just get good Republicans in office, then all will be well. But we can't get good Republicans in office if we break up the party. And you see this again and again. So parties have a falling out, and then they find their way back together, and they realize the falling out, all it does is benefit the other party.
The authoritarian tendencies of Donald Trump, because I can't imagine Ronald Reagan. He always looked at America fighting communism, totalitarianism, this authoritarianism, that, you know, tear down this wall, talking about freedom in really eloquent ways. I mean, I can't imagine, because I'm looking at Liz Cheney talking about what Dick Cheney feels about the current Republican Party. I mean, if Ronald Reagan was still old, you know, old but there, and he was here today, I wonder if he would have spoken out saying this cannot stand.
I don't know. I really hesitate to resurrect people from the past.
Of course.
Have them comment on the present. But I will say this, yes. Donald Trump did a whole lot of things that would have horrified Ronald Reagan. Would they have horrified Ronald Reagan enough that Ronald Reagan would have said, this man is not a Republican, this man is not a member of the party, or if he's the leader of the party, I'm resigning from the Republican Party? I have no way of knowing that.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that regard, I mean, Trump is by no means sort of an heir in the direct line from Ronald Reagan. It's important to remember that Donald Trump basically hijacked the Republican Party's nomination in 2016. In 2015, almost nobody considered him a real Republican at all. But he did it, and then he became the face and voice of the Republican Party. There were some Republicans, there still are some Republicans, say Donald Trump is not one of us. There are not as many of those people as much of the country would have wished have stood up and said that. But the real question, sort of, or at least the larger institutional question, is to what extent did Donald Trump actually change the course of the Republican Party? If Donald Trump should retire from politics tomorrow and really not have anything to do with it, what would happen to the Republican Party? Would it revert to the Republican Party of 2015?
Right.
Would it remain the Republican Party of Donald Trump? Would there be a civil war within the Republican Party between the sort of always Trump people and the ones who wanted to go back? This remains to be seen. Ronald Reagan had very powerful charisma. Donald Trump had and still has a very powerful charisma. They're charisma of quite different types. I sort of like to think of Ronald Reagan's charisma as their sort of positive charisma, you know, America the best it can be. And Donald Trump is a sort of negative charisma, which in many ways is often more powerful. If you play to people's fears rather than their hopes, often that's more reliable in getting them to move. But in both cases, here's somebody who draws people to himself. And behind that, is the institution of the party and what the party stands for. We saw how Reagan sort of adopted the modalities of the Republican Party in the 1970s and 1980s and shifted the Republican Party and the country with him. Donald Trump became president. He took the helm of the Republican Party. We still don't know for sure how much he has permanently changed the party. As long as he's still around, the Trump loyalists, the ones who are loyal to Trump himself, they are a large presence in the party. But do they have loyalty to the philosophy of Donald Trump? And that's really hard to say because we don't even know what the philosophy is. So in the Trump triumph, to the extent that it was a triumph, you lose the popular vote twice. You know, you win the electoral vote once, and then you lose the electoral vote the second time. It's hard to know exactly what kind of triumph that is. But it was entirely personal. People didn't vote for Trump programmatically. They voted for him because he was the one who was going to do the best to kick over the status quo. And that's what people voted for Trump for. And now, you know, what happens after Trump, the embodiment of this view, is gone? Will there be Trump 2, a Trump light? Will there be, you know, Tucker Carlson or somebody who is like Trump, but I don't know, smoother or something like that? This all remains to be seen.
I mean, would we know if there was a movement back toward a powerful conservative voice who had more of that optimism and sense of possibility? And we haven't even talked about immigration, which was such a departure from Reagan to where Trump went, and was one of those defining issues, and maybe some of the reforms under Ronald Reagan led to that being a wedge issue for Donald Trump.
I think that immigration is one of those issues where there are strong constituencies in both parties that would rather have the problem than an imperfect solution. And that wasn't true back in the 1980s. So Reagan could find a solution, could find a compromise that would satisfy enough Democrats that there could be a big immigration reform measure in 1986. There's been nothing close to it ever since, in part because of that continued sifting out of the parties. And parties understand that it is just as important to have a useful villain in the other party as it is to have a hero on your own side. And so there was a moment in the George W. Bush administration where there was talk about, okay, now we can really make progress on immigration. There was even some talk about it in the first Obama administration. But in each case, the extreme elements of the two parties sort of refused to give any ground. And the real conservatives on the Republican side basically say, you know, no more immigration, get rid of it all. And the real progressive elements or the left elements of the Democrats side basically said, you know, no restrictions on immigration. Now, they never even got close enough where they would say, okay, and this is what we actually want. They preferred having the argument so they could mobilize their base. And once you get to a point where all conservatives are Republicans and all liberals are Democrats, then what happens is each political party becomes the equivalent of the sort of the Democratic Party in the South during the days of Jim Crow. It's the primary elections that really matter. And the general election, and this combined with gerrymandering in a way that makes most seats in the House of Representatives safe for one party or the other. So if you want to be a representative from a Republican district and pick your state, all you have to worry about is whoever's coming at you over your right shoulder, who's more conservative than you. So you protect your right flank. And if you're a Democrat in a comparable district, then you worry about your left flank. And both sides realize there's nothing to be gained by moving to the middle if you're interested in keeping your job. And of course, that's the first prerequisite. Once people get into office, how can I stay in office? And you can always rationalize that by saying, I can't pass any good legislation at all if I don't stay in office.
Exactly. Why we are still living in Ronald Reagan's America, whether it's an apt title or not, after listening to H.W. Brands, you can make that determination, because I think there are interesting points of commonality and lineage and many points of departure, and in fact where Donald Trump was the antithesis of where Ronald Reagan was going with globalization, immigration, and looking at America from the sunny side of the street. Well, listen, I can't thank you enough. You've really taken us through all of this and given us a history lesson at the same time. And I had interviewed you once before, and I knew that's what we would get this time on America Trends, and I appreciate it so much.
It was great to talk to you again, Larry.